Well, hey everybody, it's great to see you, whether you're here in the room or joining us online from wherever you happen to be this July 4th weekend. Really an honor to have you along for the ride. And just a brief family update for me, we were up in Newaygo, the Great White North, you familiar, about 40 minutes north, family cottage, it was great. And I had an experience that I've never had before, and I don't know if you, I mean, I'm 51, it's been a minute. I had a 12-year-old, one of my boys, he's 12, redheaded kid, teased me for my lack of tanning ability. He's a red, they don't tan at all. And he was like, I think I'm more tan than you, Dad. I'm like, that's not even a thing. But anyway, just a little update from my world and humility and all that. Yeah. Now, as many of you know, we are in the midst of a series called The Rest of the Story, in which we're exploring some of my favorite iconic Old Testament narratives like you've probably never heard them before, because we're taking a cue from the Jewish tradition and approaching these narratives literarily. I think that's a word, right? Before we try to read them literally, in order to discover why, in spite of the more hard to believe elements in some of these stories, and if you grew up in church, you know what I'm talking about, why in spite of those elements, the Jewish people have continued to tell them to their children for literally thousands of years. They see them as inspired and sacred. And so doing this is actually an incredibly helpful thing to do, especially if you're one of those people who struggles to believe some of the details in the more bizarre Old Testament stories. If that's you, I suspect that you'll come to see what the Jewish people see when they read them, namely that the real miracles in these stories aren't necessarily just the supernatural elements in them. The real miracle is the message that these narratives convey. And so that said, with the rest of our time together today, I want to reintroduce you to another way to read one of the most famous Old Testament stories, the story of David and Goliath, right? And if you grew up in church like I did, this was probably one of your favorites. But even if you didn't grow up in church, you've probably been introduced to this story as a leadership fable. And here's what I mean. You were sitting at a conference somewhere, and a very well-polished presenter told a story of a young, inexperienced, brilliant entrepreneur who developed a product that upended an established market. In other words, they were the David who beat the Goliath, right? But today, what I want to do with our time is I don't want to approach the story like we did in Sunday school or how we approach it at leadership conferences. What I want to do is give you the rest of the story. And I'll begin by noting that beneath the surface of the David and Goliath story lies the answer to a question that is as relevant right now as it's ever been. I think it's one of the most important questions for people of faith. The question is simply this: where should we place our trust, right? Where should we place our trust? So where is the best place as we navigate a life that can be challenging in the midst of a broken world that isn't what God originally intended it to be? Where can we look to find the courage and the support and the hope that we need, especially when significant challenges enter our lives or the lives of people that we love? Those moments when we feel out of control and exposed, we reach the end of our ability to affect outcomes. And as I was preparing for today's talk, I found an article online that suggested that we humans have a tendency to place our trust in one of three things, and see if this resonates with you like it did with me. The three things are these: money, power, and people. And the author of this study argued that we naturally lean into these things, not even necessarily one of them, but all three of them, in order to help us to maintain our peace. However, and this is where things get really interesting, we do this even though deep down we know that each of these things can ultimately fail us, right? So take, for example, money. I mean, it certainly can offer us options in life, right? It can provide us with temporary comfort and convenience, and we can use it to buy machines that can make our lives easier and more entertaining. And it can offer us opportunities to travel and to learn and to grow, and that's all good. But if we're being honest, money also has its limits, right? The limits to what it can accomplish. It can't heal broken relationships, right? It can't buy you love. The Beatles said that. Thank you. Right, yeah. And it can't ultimately protect our physical health. So it's an unstable foundation for our ultimate trust because there are forces that are just beyond its ability to control. Stock markets can crash. Real estate values can tank. And when those things happen, we can be left feeling vulnerable and even a bit hopeless. Consequently, in the end, even though it's tempting, right, money isn't a great place to place your trust. See, it can also be tempting to place our trust in power, right? To lean emotionally on the idea that we or those with whom we share an allegiance have authority or influence, like they or we can control because of the power we hold. But here's the thing, you can be given and power can be taken away from you, from me, and from others. And moreover, even when it's given, it has its limits. Like it only can do so much. And so consequently, in the end, power isn't a great place to place our trust either. Finally, it's natural to place our trust in people. But if you've been around at all, you've probably experienced that that isn't really a great idea. We've all been disappointed when people we trust let us down. Maybe it's a parent or a coach or a friend, or even a spouse. So all things considered, people aren't a great place to place our trust either. And so what are we to do as we navigate life as broken people in a broken world, and there's all these things that happen beyond our control? Where can we place our trust? Unfortunately, there's another admittedly counterintuitive option. And as it turns out, that option, I would argue, is embodied in the story of David and Goliath. And with the rest of our time together this morning, I want to show you why I say that. And before we get to the story, a bit of context. The conflict between David and Goliath is said to have occurred around 1,000 years before the time of Jesus, during a season in which Israel was in the midst of a series of violent military conflicts with a group of people called the Philistines. And if you read the Old Testament, the Philistines are like the Klingons in the Star Trek universe. You know what I'm talking about? The Galactic Empire. They're the bad guys every time they show up. It's like, and then there was this great Philistine. You'll never see it, right? But the Philistines were a seafaring people who came to live along Israel's Mediterranean coastline in the south. And during the time of David and Goliath, they wanted to expand their influence inward. And that situation was complicated by the fact that the Philistines in ancient times, around 1,000 years ago, had mastered iron technology, which both made them wealthy and gave them a significant advantage in battle. In fact, according to the author of the Old Testament narrative we call 1 Samuel, the people of ancient Israel actually had to rely on the Philistines to maintain their iron equipment. He wrote this. He said, "Not a blacksmith," in other words, not a one, "could be found in the whole land of Israel, because the Philistines," again, the bad guys, "said, otherwise the Hebrews will make swords or spears, and we can't have that. So all Israel went down to the Philistines to have their plow points, their mattocks, their axes, and their sickles sharpened." And you know how it is when your mattock gets dull, right? It's life doesn't, I have no idea what that is, but you get the idea. Probably some sort of farm implement. But there's a noted Bible scholar and archaeologist named Baruch Halpin, and he described the implications of this Philistine iron monopoly this way in a recent book. He said, "The Philistines' control of iron technology created a strategic imbalance that allowed them to dominate their neighbors militarily until Israel developed comparable capabilities." And so that's kind of the behind-the-scenes context for the David and Goliath story. And so with that, let's jump into the narrative. So here's how the author sets it up. He wrote this. He said, "The Philistines gathered their forces for war, and Israel's king Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up their battle line to meet the Philistines. So the Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another, with the valley in between them." And this is so cool. You can actually visit the Valley of Elah. I've been there a bunch, and it's a pretty cool space because you can visualize this story. This is a photo that I found on the interweb of the Valley of Elah. These buildings obviously were not there in ancient times, but that goes without saying, right? But the Valley of Elah in ancient times was a very significant thing geographically. It runs east to west in Israel, which means it provided a way to move troops from the Mediterranean coast up into the mountains near Jerusalem, which is only about 12 miles away from where the story of David and Goliath occurred. So practically speaking, this meant that if the Philistines took control of the Elah Valley, they could eventually take over all of Israel. It was that big a deal. Okay, so as the narrative continues, we learn the following. A champion named Goliath came out of the Philistine camp. His height was 6 cubits and a span. He wore a coat of scale armor. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and its iron point weighed 600 shekels. So just notice, and I highlighted the words, but the author described both Goliath's height and the weight of the iron tip of his rod using the number 6. And that doesn't mean much to us, but it very likely meant something to the first people to hear the story. And here's why I say that. In the Jewish tradition, the number 6 often carries the sense of opposition to God. So it can mean 6, but it also means something that operates in opposition to God. And this idea actually shows up in the New Testament as well, in a letter that we call Revelation, which is a mysterious document right at the end of the New Testament. An early Jesus follower named John leveraged the number 666, which he called the number of the beast, in order to describe an individual he referred to as the Antichrist. So you've got some of those undertones in the description of Goliath. But anyway, as the account continues, we learn that Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle?" In other words, you are going to get trounced if you do it that way. Choose a man, just one, and have him come down to me. If he's able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects, your servants, your slaves. But if I overcome and kill him, he'll serve us. And again, this is one of those things that, if you're paying attention, this was not a bad option for Israel. I mean, Goliath presented them with an opportunity. Because of the iron technology we talked about, the Philistines had an incredible advantage in battle. And so if the armies were to go to war, it's likely that many Israelite soldiers would have been lost. But see, in Goliath's proposal, only one man needed to die in order to decide the battle's outcome. It was a proposal that ancient people called individual combat, and it actually happened quite often in ancient times. It was popular because it limited the cost of war. But there's something else going on, too. It was also considered a valid way to determine the outcome of a battle, because ancient peoples saw battle not just as army versus army, but as God versus God. So they believed that as they fought on earth, their gods fought in heaven, and the winner of the heavenly battle would be manifested by the victor of the human one. Nonetheless, when faced with the opportunity to fight Goliath, we learn that Saul, that's Israel's first king, he's the guy at the tent in the battle, and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. So Goliath gives them a good option, and no one wants to take him up on it. And it's easy to miss, but this statement is ironic, because at this moment, the armies of Israel needed a champion, and so they would have looked first to their king, because in a very real sense, they had placed their trust in him. And to be honest, from their perspective, that wasn't an entirely illogical thing to do. The authors of the earlier documents in the Old Testament record that Saul was among the tallest men in Israel. And so it would be logical to assume that when a giant challenged the armies of Israel to a one-on-one battle, they would have looked to their tallest guy to defend them, their leader. That's where they put their trust. Moreover, as best we can tell, Saul owned one of only 2 suits of armor needed in all of Israel. And so not only was one of the tallest guys, he was one of the only 2 guys that would have had the gear needed to face Goliath. However, instead of engaging with the giant, Saul stayed in his tent day after day after day. And with each passing day, his credibility and his people's hope for a favorable outcome to the conflict slipped away. The king had failed his people. Now, before we go any farther, I just want to note something. God never wanted ancient Israel to have a king in the first place. He wanted Israel to be a theocracy, a fancy word, basically. He wanted to be their king. He wanted them to trust in him. He wanted them to place, he wanted to be the place where they placed their trust. But see, a few years before the incident with Goliath, the people of Israel had all but demanded that they be given a king. They went to their leader. He was a judge, they called him at the time, a man named Samuel. And they just said to Samuel, listen, appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have. Like, all the cool kids have a king. We want one too, right? And you've heard this if you have kids, right? We want one too. But here's the thing. In this moment, they forgot that God had established Israel for a specific purpose. And that purpose went way beyond them. Like, Israel was to be like no other nation. They were to be set apart. They were to let God lead them. And in so doing, they were to be a light in the world. They were part of God's plan to reveal himself to the whole world. Nonetheless, at this moment in their history, they wanted a human king. And in response to their request, Samuel prayed to God, and God responded, and he said that the people have rejected me as their king. He says, now, Samuel, listen to them, but warn them solemnly and let them know what the king who will reign over them will claim as his rights. Like, circle back with them. There's a cost to this decision. I'll permit it, but this is not what they think it's going to be. Like, let the people know they can have their king, but the king is going to draft their sons for battle. The king will tax them heavily. And the king will claim the best lands for himself. And so Samuel goes back to the people and he says, hey, listen, God says, okay, but it's not going to go like you want it to go. And the people insisted they wanted a king. And that demand really set the stage for the story of David, who years after the incident with Goliath would become Israel's second king and Israel's greatest king. And to be clear, David wasn't Israel's greatest king because he was perfect. A few of y'all remember the Bathsheba thing. Remember that? Yeah, not perfect. But what made David great was his love for the law of God and his trust in God. And this set him apart. Because kings don't generally love laws they didn't create, right? They typically adjust laws when it serves their purposes. But see, David loved God's law. God is where he placed his trust, even when it condemned his behavior. He saw the law as a gift. And that conviction gave him incredible insight as he served as Israel's king. Moreover, if you read the story of David's life, and you should in the Old Testament, it's amazing, but David never became confused as to the identity of Israel's true king. It's like, call me whatever you want, but there is one to whom I bend the knee. Like, in spite of his popularity and his success, he never lost that clarity. And that is a powerful thing. Because if we're being honest, for most of us, and I speak of me, that's not the case. Like, whenever we attain a little bit of success, whether it's in sales or with family or with academics or vocationally, we quickly find ourselves climbing up on the throne of our lives. And whenever that happens, our trust naturally migrates towards our own strengths and abilities. Of course it does, because we always place our trust in whatever it is that we think we can depend on the most. See, but David never made that mistake, not even when he entered the story with Goliath. So let's jump in there now. As the account continues, we learn that one day, David, he's a teenager, brought a care package to his brothers who were part of King Saul's army. And when David arrived at the Valley of Elah, he heard Goliath taunting the children of Israel and was incredibly offended. And so he asked the men standing near him, and this is great, who is this uncircumcised Philistine? Like, that's a little personal. Yeah. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And we have to imagine, like, the soldiers who heard David would have been stunned by his question because, well, they had not thought of Goliath as a disgrace. They weren't thinking about how he was reflecting on their God, they viewed him as a one-man killing machine of whom they were terrified. But see, at this moment, David demonstrated clarity. He saw Goliath and the Philistines were attempting to this God land that his God had given to his people. And so David basically asked, who does this guy think he is, and why hasn't anyone done something about this? And so word begins to spread. There's this young shepherd who's bringing he's not a soldier. He brought a care package to his brothers, and he is upset about Goliath. And eventually word gets back to King Saul. And Saul requests an audience with David. And David walks into the tent, and as he walks through the tent, Saul immediately recognized that David is not a soldier. He's a teen boy who spends his days hanging out with his family's sheep. He's no match for the Philistines' premier warrior, and so Saul tries to dismiss him, but I love this. David resisted eviction. He just stood there, and then he boldly asked Saul for permission to stand up to Goliath on behalf of the nation. He said, despite of my lack of military experience, he said, I have killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them because he has defied the armies of the living God, not because of me, but because of who he has picked a fight with. He goes on. He says, the Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of this Philistine. I love David's confidence in this moment, but I think I love even more where it was rooted. Like that day, standing on a hill overlooking the Valley of Elah, David saw things in a way no one else did because he had placed his trust somewhere no one else had. And so even when faced with an impossible situation, David found courage. And he became the living embodiment of a truth that many of us have experienced, however imperfectly, namely that people who trust in God, and I don't mean just say they trust in God, but people who truly put their trust in God need not fear even when there is something to fear. You need not fear when there's nothing to fear, but this is where the rubber hits the road. Even when there is something to fear, you don't need to fear because of where you placed your trust. And I'm telling you, David was so convinced of this that he asked Saul to let him do what no other man was willing to do. I think it's interesting that later in his life, David wrote poetry that was included in the Old Testament that gives us a window into how he saw the world. And at one point, David declared this. He said, to you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. In you I trust. Show me your ways, O Lord. Teach me your paths. Teach me to walk. Guide me in your truth and teach me, for you are God, my Savior, and my hope, my faith, my trust is in you all day long. And you should know when David wrote this, life wasn't easy. He was running for his life. And so here's what I know. If we were to somehow ask David where we should choose to place our trust, because it's a choice, even though we don't think of it that way, he wouldn't point to money. He wouldn't point to power, and he wouldn't point to people. He'd point to God. And he would say that in a broken world, that we live as broken people among other broken people, the only God is worthy of our trust because only he can ultimately control outcomes in life. Like you find yourself in an impossible situation, you can't do anything else, where are you going to lean? He's like, you should lean on the only place you ever should lean. You should lean on him. You should trust him. You put your faith in him. Moreover, only trust in God can provide you peace in spite of impossible circumstances. This is the promise of a life with living faith. Okay, back to the story. So David made his way down to the Valley of Elah in what had to be a painfully awkward moment. I mean, just imagine this. The Philistines were lined up watching Goliath, they would have thought this had to be some sort of joke, right? And the armies of Israel lined up on the other hill looking down as this scrawny teenager starts walking towards this giant. They would have been terrified because remember, if David fell to Goliath, which was like 100% going to happen in their minds, right? They'd have to become the servants, the slaves of the Philistines. So they would have thought, you got to be kidding me. Why would Saul have ever agreed to this? The unthinkable was unfolding right before their eyes. And as the story continues, Goliath repeated his threats, and David responded with some swagger. You, he said, come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. He's like, you need to understand, you're not fighting me, Goliath. You're fighting him. And Goliath is, in my mind, laughing at this point, right? David goes on, this day the Lord will deliver you into my hands and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. I love that he had a plan. This very day I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals and the whole world will know, and this is the point, not that David's a great warrior, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel, because that is what God's plan was. He wanted to introduce himself to the world as the creator, as the lover, as the power behind this life. And then, as the narrative continued, David's words actually became prophetic. The author recorded this. David took his staff in his hand, chose five smooth stones from the stream, put them in the pouch of his shepherd's bag, and with his sling in hand, approached the Philistine. And this is the moment, right? This is the moment where the underdog takes down the established power. But here's what's so fascinating. When you dig into the rest of the story, you find that the people who study this sort of thing note that in the hands of a trained slinger, a stone can be a deadly weapon. They also tell us that in ancient times, armies were organized into three groups. You had infantry, you had cavalry, and you had artillery, which included slingers. They also tell us that stones can exit slings at upwards of 100 miles an hour. So Goliath is infantry. He's the big, strong guy with the sword and the armor. David is artillery. All that to say, as soon as David grabbed his sling, it didn't really matter how tall Goliath was, because as they say, you don't bring a knife to a gunfight, right? I thought that was going to land. Just, yeah. Remember the Indiana Jones, the first one, right? And the guy has the sword, he's doing his thing, and Indiana pulls out a gun and shoots him, and we all laughed. Remember that? Yeah, that's basically what we got in David and Goliath. So the author described the action this way. He wrote, as the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly towards the battle line to meet him, reaching into his bag, taking out a stone. He slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into the forehead and he fell face down on the ground. I mean, this is so awesome. David didn't fight Goliath on Saul's terms or on Goliath's terms. And he didn't even need armor because, I mean, he needed only the skills he had developed protecting his family's sheep from lions. And so David killed Goliath with a sling and a stone and in an instant became the most popular man in Israel. He did what King Saul refused to do, because I would argue he saw what King Saul refused to see. Which brings us to the big idea for today, and it's an idea that's as true for you and me as it was for David, and it simply goes like this. Trust in God makes us brave. Trust in God makes us brave. We can find courage, even in situations that feel hopelessly out of control, when we place our trust in God. And I've worked as a pastor now for over 20 years. And in that time, I have come to recognize that people who choose to trust in God aren't just exercising wishful thinking. More often than not, these are people who've reached a place where they've recognized that they are ultimately incapable of controlling the most important outcomes in their life. And they've rightly acknowledged that there are simply too many factors outside of their influence. They can control some stuff, we can control some stuff, and we can, but we should not live with under the disillusionment that we can control everything. And so these people decide that once they've done everything they know to do, they just release the anxiety and they trust God with the rest. And that trust has given them the courage to face the darkest seasons of this life. And so that said, before I close this down in prayer, I just want to ask you a question. What would change if you did what David did? If you put your trust in the only one who can ultimately control the outcomes, like how would your life, how would my life be different? I mean, just imagine if in the midst of your greatest successes and your greatest failures and your greatest challenges, in those moments when it seems like your Goliath is going to take you down, in those moments when your Goliath does take you down, because that happens too, right? You simply open your hands and say what David said, "To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. In you I trust. My hope, my faith is in you, God, all day long." What would that change for you? What would that change for me? I would argue it would change everything. Because that's the place from which our Creator desires us to live. That's where he wants us to place our trust. I told a story a few years back. It's worth repeating. I had a friend who taught me more about this than anyone else. I mean, because it's theological concepts until you actually live through something. But years ago, I had a series of conversations along these lines with a friend named Timmy, who was coming to the end of a five-year battle with cancer. And she called me one day and she said, "Hey, I would like you to visit me at my home. I've entered hospice care and I want you to come once a week until I pass. Hospice assigned me a pastor and he is that youthable." And I was simultaneously like, "Oh, I feel so honored that you think I'm acceptable." And then thought, "Boy, I don't want to cross you right now because you seem, you know, like I hope I remain acceptable." But anyway, great friend. And so I was thrilled to accept the invitation. And over a period of about 6 weeks, Timmy and I sat first at her kitchen table, and then I sat on the side of her bed, and we talked. And they were some of the richest conversations I've ever had. She was literally knocking on heaven's door. And we talked about life, and we talked about God, and we talked about marriage, and we talked about heaven, and we talked about kids, and we talked about faith, and we talked about fear, and we talked about what matters most in the end. And I remember the day that I looked in her, she had these bright blue eyes, and I said, how have you so completely come to peace with death? Because there's a lot of stuff in life that I feel like I can get myself to peace with, but death is just so unknown. Like, how in the world did you get there? And she said, "Oh, how do you come to peace with the unknowable and the uncontrollable? Lots of practice." She said, "Years ago, I gave up trying to control things that I couldn't control. And I decided that once I did all I knew I could do to affect a relationship or a situation or a financial thing or a vocational thing or whatever, I was just going to let go and let God. I was going to trust him with the rest." And she said, with a smile on her face, couple days before she died, she says, "Once you do that, you really have nothing to fear. Because he's good and he's got you. Even when things don't go your way, even when the cancer doesn't cure, even when the financial situation doesn't reverse, he still loves you, he's still got you." And I remember thinking, that's it. That's the secret. And that, my friends, is the rest of the story of David and Goliath, and I love it, and that's why I hope you love it too. And that's why the Jewish people continue to tell this story to their kids, because they want them to understand that God alone is worthy of their trust. And with that, I'd love to close our time in prayer. Would you stand? And once again this week, if you're visiting or you're here every week and you would love someone to pray with you before you head out to the parking lot, we have some friends that'll be under the screen to the left. But for the rest of us, let me close our time. Heavenly Father, thank you for being the only one who is truly worthy of our trust. Thank you for loving us even when we are unlovable, and thank you for inviting us to trust even at our lowest moment. I pray that we would be a people who would experience the peace that passes understanding, because your spirit within us reminds us that you've got us. And so that once we've done everything that we can think to do, we just trust you with the rest. I pray for those of us who right now are navigating a season when something feels like a Goliath and it's staring us down. I pray that you would whisper to them that you've got them and that you love them. Whatever the outcome, you've got them and you love them. And so for today, we thank you. We thank you for the grace in which we stand. We thank you for who you are and what you've done. And I ask for your grace and your peace to rest on us all. In the matchless name of your Son, our Savior, Jesus Christ, we pray. And everyone said, amen. Friends, it's been so great to be with you. Have a wonderful day. We'll see you next week.